All right. Welcome, everyone, to another Wednesday evening here on peoplesinternetradio.com. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this is Cancel a Cabal. I have a very special guest. I have an investigative journalist on. Her name is Janet Phelan. I'm going to read a little bit of her bio. Janet Phelan is an investigative journalist whose articles have appeared in the LA Times, San Bernardino County Sentinel, Santa Monica Daily Press, Long Beach Press, Telegram, O Magazine. Oi, is that
We?
We, okay. Sorry about the mispronunciation of the French, but We Magazine and other regional national publications. In 2004, she jumped ship and now exclusive rights for independent media. Her poetry has been published in Gambit, Libera, Apple Zaba Review, Nausea One, and other magazines. I'm glad I got that last one right. I kind of butchered the other two, but her first book, The Hitler Poems, was published in 2005. Her groundbreaking expose, Exile, was published in May of 2014, and is available on thebookpatch.com, which I will be providing a link for the people in the chat room here just as soon as I get done and announce her, bring her up. Formerly a talk show host for KSKQ, Republic Broadcasting Network, Janet maintains a vigorous schedule of guesting on radio shows across America and Canada. She currently resides in Latin America. And I'm going to give a little bit of synopsis of Janet's book, Exile. Oops, I'm sorry. In the year 2000, an out-of-work reporter is approached by a man who is not whom he appears to be. Lured into a romantic affair with him, the reporter is soon to lose everything, her family, her home, her country, and nearly her life. Exile is a true story of Janet Phelan, who fled the U.S. after attempts to permanently silence her went awry. The lengths to which the intelligence community will go to cover their tracks is revealed in this memoir. The ultimate question, what is the meaning behind this grave assault on the American citizen, unfolds as a story is told. Welcome to the show, Janet. Very, very interesting.
Thank you very much for having me on, Stephen.
You're very, very welcome. I guess the first question I have is what led to this encounter with this mysterious man you referred to in the book?
Well, it's a very strange story that unfolded. In the year 2000, as the promo, the little blurb says, I was out of work. I'd had some medical problems, which I was struggling to overcome, and I was basically kind of knocked out of the game. And I was approached by a man named Jack Leonard Smith. As it turns out, this was not his name of origin. After the events that took place in the book, which simply turned my life upside down, after they took place, I did get a private investigator to look at Jack Smith, who the PI reported back, not to my surprise at that point in time, that my ex-boyfriend was a spook and that he had never existed before around 1991, that he'd simply dropped from the sky into the condominium he was living in West Hollywood when he first approached me, and that not only that, but that his place of employment, his official employment, was a cutout, all of which I at that point had figured out, but was glad to have, you know, the affirmation and documentation. What I think is really, there are a lot of details in the book. You know, what happened? What did he do? You know, what happened as a result of his involvement in my life? What happened as a result was murder and mayhem. What I think is really relevant about the book is that this proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that intelligence operatives are basically engaged in activities inside the borders of the United States, where they are targeting non-terrorists, non-threats, for the purpose of murder and mayhem. And I think that this is the true, you know, significance of the book. Now, I can give some details, kind of a synopsis of what happened.
Sure.
As a result. of okay. Essentially,
we don't want any spoilers or anything, but go ahead.
Oh no, I'm happy to kind of give a framework here. There, like as I said, there's an awful lot of details given that basically, in a sense, this book may be seen as a manual for how to survive, lethal targeting by, intelligence agencies. There are details given as to, types of entrapment. For example, at one point after the events were unfolding in a very horrible way in the book, and I became aware that, my life had been essentially turned into a sort of a Perils of Pauline. I had come home. At this point, I had been with Jack for, I think, about a year and a half. I had left him. I was just left him, and I had been away for a few days and came home to find that my house had been tossed. I was at that point renting like a house behind a house, and the landlady was living in the front house, and I'm walking alongside the path, but beside the landlady's house towards my house, and I hear her say, "Oh, she's here, quick, call the police." Now, thank goodness I heard that. I walk into my house, and my house has been ransacked. Now, generally, if you go home and your house has been ransacked, you call the police. But I'm thinking, but the police are already coming. Why would that be? And so I'm looking around my house, and I'm trying to figure out what's happening. And I see on the floor all these pink pills, not mine, drugs scattered all over my floor. So at that point, already understanding that some very peculiar things had been going on in my life subsequent to my involvement with Jack, I realized that the police are coming to basically arrest me for drugs, which is...
Drug paraphernalia? Yeah.
Drugs themselves. There were pills. I have no idea what they were. They weren't mine, but they're all over the floor. So... I thought as fast as I could. I closed all the windows, shut the shades, and I started scooping and flushing as fast as I could. The police are on their way.
Yeah.
I got drugs in my house. Within about 7 or 8 minutes, the bam, bam, bam comes on the door. And at that point, I'd sort of sealed off the house from, casual. You couldn't look in a window or something. So I just held my breath, and bam, bam, bam again. And then they retreated. And so I finished the scooping and flushing, and my landlady, who, thank goodness, had a very loud voice that carried, was walking in the backyard with her housemate, and she said, "Oh, well, darn, she must have left by the other way. Well, sooner or later, they'll get her." So there was targeting going on. Now, why was this targeting going on? What was happening? So this is what I'd like to get into as concisely as possible. I was approached by Jack Smith in late 2000, and Jack began to wine me and dine me and, take me out to, this was launch a relationship. And after a few months of our being an item, suddenly I'm told I have to move out of my apartment. The landlady is becoming insistent. She won't tell me why. I'm trying to find another place to live, and lo and behold, I can't even get a return phone call. I simply can't find another apartment. This is, very peculiar, but I'm not at this point understanding that my boyfriend's a spook. He never told me he's a spook. He never told me that, that there was targeting going on. So I'm trying to find a place to live and can't do it. So I called up my new boyfriend, said, "Jack, can I come stay with you for a while? My landlady's kicking me out." So essentially they parked me with him. And as soon as they parked me with him, there began to be a focus on the situation of my mother. My mother at that point was in her early 80s. Dr. Emily Phelan, clinical psychologist, had recently retired. And just to sort of make the situation compact, on Jack's direction and urging, my mother ended up under an adult guardianship. Now, it is not widely known in the U.S. at this point in time because the media has been fairly, shall we say, negligent in covering what happens under adult guardianships.
Yes.
But an adult guardianship is essentially, they've created a constitutional loophole by which upon allegations alone, that a person is lacking capacity or getting older or, you know, has having some sort of competency problems, allegations alone with no standard of proof, a person can go into court, say that such and such a person is obviously needs help, and wham, the court slaps you with an adult guardianship. Upon the initiation of this, and you may not even be advised that these proceedings are taking place, okay, there's loopholes for that too. Upon the initiation, you lose all access to your assets and the lion's share of your constitutional rights. You lose the right, most likely, to vote. You lose the right, because you have no more assets under your control, you cannot even hire an attorney to defend against the guardianship. You lose your ability to choose your social relationships, who you will see, who you won't see, the ability to determine where you live, whether or not you get medical care. Basically, you become the property of the guardian. Now, in a society, in a situation where there is benevolence and concern for people in a situation like this, you know, people might be cared for. However, as in the current situation in the United States, what we've got here is a group of targeted people who are quickly fleeced of their assets by the professional guardians, and when their assets run out, generally the people are very often medically euthanized. Now, that may be so shocking and so unbelievable that your audience may not, you know, may think, wait a second, this has just gone too far. So in order to support the allegations that this is going on, I want to encourage people, first of all, to check out the website of the National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse. You will see story after story of people's parents being medically murdered after their assets run out. Now, in the case of my mother the involvement of federal agent Jack Smith, the situation was a little bit different because my mother was not fleeced, then murdered. My mother was murdered. Murdered. And then the assets at that point, you know, remained to be taken or not. My mother had been under a guardianship at that point for about less than six months. I had noticed I was coming down from West Hollywood, where I was at that point living with my mortal enemy, you know, not knowing that the man who had wined me and dined me and just completely swept me off my feet, not knowing that he was actually in the employ of eugenicists,
yes,
of an intelligence agency, and so I'd gotten. So my mom had basically been living in Temecula, which is Riverside County, and she'd been under the guardianship for a few months. I noticed that my mother, who was in really pretty good shape for a woman her age, only recently retired. You know, she'd had a PhD. She was a very bright woman. And she had taken pretty good care of herself physically, although she did have some heart problems that she was taking medicine for. Well, suddenly I noticed that she's just not doing very well and seems to be going downhill. And then I get a phone call from her in which she said, I am very ill and no one's paying attention to me. Now, at this point, my mother's under a guardianship. The guardian, who had been basically chosen by Jack Smith, was attempting to block my seeing my mother at every possible juncture. I'd show up, she'd call to the house, threatened to call the police on me. It was going on and on. So I get this call from my mom, and I speed down to Temecula to see what's going on. The guardian had hired caregivers to live in the house with my mother, which seemed rather superfluous, as my mother was pretty, you know, capable of taking care of herself. Nevertheless, I arrive at the house. My mother is in terrible shape. She can hardly walk. She seems to be extremely confused. I'm alarmed. I call the guardian. I say, I'm taking her to the emergency room. I take her to the emergency room. She is evaluated and admitted, and shortly thereafter trundled into cardiac surgery as her heart is failing. Now, I go back to the house where my mother was living. The caregivers immediately flee. You know, they pack up and go. It's like a lot of drama and the sort of confusion. And I go and check my mother's medicine because I want to, you know, figure out what's going on here. No one had bothered to give my mother her heart medicine in about 2 months. There are full undispensed bottles for the, you know, the months preceding. So at that point, I call the police. My sister, who was also being paid by the conservator to take care of my mother, goes in and locks herself in the room. The police come. They count the pills. They take a police report. They go away. Within 2 days, I am served with notice that the guardian, a woman named Melody Scott, who has quite a trail behind her of situations where there are allegations of negligence and worse. Didn't know that at the time, unfortunately, but the guardian went into court and declared on paper, and this document is reproduced in the book, that I had unnecessarily transported my mother to the hospital, thereby upsetting her, and I needed to be permanently restrained from my mother. Now, also reproduced in the book is the medical record showing, you know, the state my mother was in, the evaluation, and the fact that she needed surgery to save her life. So I'm thinking, well, this is a very bad guardian, and this is going to be really easy because I'm going to go to court, and I'll explain to the judge what happened, and, you know, this is all going to go away. So on the date of my scheduled hearing, this document is also reproduced in the book, I go to court. I am documented as being in court when court opens and when court closes. And my restraining order was never called to hearing, and I was permanently restrained from my mother without due process. So this is sort of how the drama really got initiated and launched. There was what was a clear attempt on my mother's life. And when, you know, the daughter takes the appropriate steps, the daughter is basically denied all rights of due process and separated from any possibility of protecting her mother again. So under those circumstances, my mother did not survive very long. And after this issue with the restraining order, suddenly Jack begins to act like an insane sort of rampaging bull, and I basically leave him and move back into this little cottage in Long Beach, where immediately it became Target Central.
I've got about five quick questions that have popped up already,
do.
Janet. someone wants to know, well, I will take them in order. I don't want to step on anyone's toes because there's a lot of good questions.
Great.
Has the targeting continued since you left the States?
Yes.
Has it? Okay.
Yes.
And
there are problems. I'm in Mexico now, and there are problems here that are not quite as intense as what ended up occurring, because there's, you know, we're sort of like at the launch, and what I was explaining, they're sort of at the launch part of what happened. But there are problems here for me, and I am reevaluating whether or not I should stay here or possibly go somewhere else.
Go somewhere else, yeah. Who was actually the initial target? Was it you or your mother?
Well, see, this is a very good question. You know, in a sense, I'm still on the outside looking in. Nobody has given me requested my FBI NSA files, and they've refused simply to, you know, honor my FOIAs. I believe this was a twofer.
Okay.
And, yeah, I believe it was. And I also, well, I'll answer the questions as they come. Okay.
Do you have any theories on why both you and your mother were targeted?
I certainly do. And what I have done in the book, it's entitled Exile, is to go through the story of what happened to her, what happened to me as I began to become fiercer and fiercer in terms of first trying to protect her and then trying to, you know, yell at the top of my lungs to the world as to what was going on. The book is largely, you know, telling the story of what happened. But there, towards the end, I do make a very concerted effort to put this into framework. What the conclusions that I've come to is that the U.S. is engaged in what I call demographic targeting. The elderly are certainly victims of this.
I do know one thing. I took care of my dad the last 10 years of his life, Janet. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He had renal failure the last 2 years of his life. Mm-hmm. So he was on kidney dialysis. He was in, I had to put him in a home. He got just too lethargic and too weak in the last 6 months of his life. This was in 2008. They, at the time, were taking, they were taking all of his Social Security and pension that he was getting from his job that he had, which was, you know, only amounted to $1,200 and some odd a month. But they ended up charging the federal government over $5,200 every month for his care. So I know money has a very, very large part in playing on what they do to the elderly.
I think it does. And I think there are different levels that are involved in this. I think, you know, the one of the lower levels, for example, the Guardians for Profit, the nursing homes, et cetera, are certainly operating off financial incentives. However, I think that the reasons for this go also into issues of eugenics.
Yes.
And I think this is one of the dirty little secrets going on inside the United States now, that there are eugenics programs up and running. And I think to kind of summarize the conclusions that I've come to, this is not only an age-related program. I believe that there are also racial groups are being absolutely targeted. And that there are plans in place that are going to essentially ravage
certainly
the existence of certain groups.
Yes, that is absolutely one of the main reasons why they've been taking children's blood since 1974. They can manufacture race-specific bioweapons.
They can also manufacture individual-specific bioweapons.
Individual-specific, yes.
And actually, this is, in a sense, where some of my research began to go. I've written extensively on the issue of eugenics and race-specific bioweapons, and along the way, and this is also recorded in the later chapters of my book, Exile, I traveled to Geneva, Switzerland, and in 2011, I testified in front of the Biological Weapons Convention in Geneva, Switzerland, as to the existence of covert chemical bio delivery systems within the U.S. that could selectively deliver chemicals, biologicals, in a sort of false flag pandemic. And I was able, through some concerted effort, to get some blueprints and documents to support my contentions that these delivery systems exist. So following the circumstances that, basically destroyed my family, I embarked on, a new leg of my journalistic career in an attempt to expose what is basically a eugenics agenda in the United States.
Oh, yes, yes. That's the that also is known as the Agenda 21, as a lot of people realize, but a lot of people don't really know that. They put a flowery, fluffy name on eugenics, and it's called Agenda 21, basically. Another question, quick, if I can,
yeah.
Janet. Somebody would like to know, a UK prepper would like to know if you've thought about taking care of your mother instead of putting her into guardianship.
I was taking care of my mother.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And, I did not... that question is completely. I would suggest that UK Prepper read the book.
Yeah.
Because as was mentioned earlier, you know, in the show, these guardianships can be initiated without even informing the person, targeted person,
certainly,
that the proceedings are taking place. In fact, recently in California, a new law was passed. You know, we have professional guardians and we have public guardian. A new law was passed that says that the public guardian, simply on the intent to apply for guardianship, can go in and seize a person's assets. So they don't even have to initiate the court action.
Yeah.
It's simply having the intent. So, you know, this is not a straightforward sort of, oh, just don't put your parent into guardianship. These guardianships can and are launched without information or consent.
Yes, yes. And another question from Lori. She would like to know if your mother, I think as carriers, but I'm not sure, carriers maybe, did they not have drug sheets to sign legal binding documents that make carers, I'm sorry. If your mother had carers, did they not have drug sheets that they had to sign for legal binding documents making the carer liable?
Liability and enforcement of laws always depends on the intentionality of the enforcer.
Sure.
For example, I think this is a good question. I think it really is. And I think it goes to one of the deep concerns going on among those who are afflicted by what has, you know, happened to their loved ones under guardianship. For example, when I filed the police report with the, you know, the police concerning no one giving my mother her medication, this was, you know, evidence of an act of criminal negligence on the part of either the caregivers or possibly the guardian or whoever was, you know, whoever was micromanaging this situation. When the enforcing agency, when law enforcement refuses to uphold the laws and refuses to enforce the laws, then you have an entirely different kettle of fish. And I'd like to mention, for just to give an example of this, right now in Chicago, we have a couple of lawyers. One is Kendit Kautsky, the other is Joanne Dennison. And both of these individuals were attempting to cope with the kinds of abuses going on to people under adult guardianship. In the case of Kendit Kautsky, he took it upon himself to notify the Attorney General of the United States, basically sent in reports. For his efforts, Ken Ditkowski had his law license suspended for 4 years.
Which Attorney General was that?
Holder.
Holder, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So this is very recent that he's in the last year.
Has it?
The other lawyer, and these are only examples because this is happening all over America, okay? The other lawyer, Joanne Dennison, basically, you know, became alerted to these kind of abuses and decided to start a blog. The blog is MaryGSykes.com. And on this blog, Joanne is putting up legal documents about, you know, abusive guardianships. There is a comment, you know, on certain things that are happening in court. And Joanne Dennison just recently had her trial in front of the, you know, State Bar Group. It's the Illinois Attorney Registration and Disciplinary Commission. For her acts of attempting to inform the public about these abuses, she has been recommended for the 3-year suspension of her license to practice law. Not for any action she took. There's no allegations that she took a bad action in a case, you know, that she did something, you know, in a courtroom or in a legal situation that was unethical. It was solely for basically exercising her First Amendment rights to inform the public that, you know, Houston, we got a problem here.
Yeah.
But not only, you know, not only are elders being targeted in this matter, but those who are attempting to protect them. And I want to give a couple more instances of this.
Sure.
In Florida right now, there is a woman named Barbara Stone who is on house arrest. She has an ankle bracelet. Her bad act Her mother was under an adult guardianship. She went to see her mother after some hospitalizations, etc., was appalled that her mother was wasting away to nothing. So she took her mother to Denny's. And for this, she is facing a potential, she's on house arrest, pending trial, and is facing potentially 5 years in prison.
That's amazing.
There's one more. Because sure. this is actually hot off the presses. There's a lady named Gail Hammer, also in San Bernardino County, who was arrested, I believe it was on Sunday, this past Sunday. Gail Hammer has been attempting to bring to light the abuses that her mother, Kathleen Durham, is experiencing under an adult guardianship in San Bernardino County with a guardian named Larry Dean. And there is financial mismanagement. There's also physical neglect of Kathleen Durham. So Gail is, you know, contacted this reporter, and I was beginning to kind of look at the situation and so forth. And I was on the phone with Gail on Sunday when the police showed up and took her to West Valley Detention on charges of financial elder abuse.
Oh, boy.
So she's now facing trial. Interesting. I want to say some things, too, about how the system is reacting to the Hammer situation, because I was attempting to find out, you know, which police agency, which detective. I found out that that they're not going to tell you which detective investigated this. So I pulled a little act of subterfuge, and you know, I found out that it was, you know, which station it was, and I called and said, I have information about the Hammer case. You know, I got to tell you stuff about Gail Hammer. At that point, they told me who the detective was. So I spoke with him today, and they won't even tell you what, you know, essentially what she's being charged with. It's financial elder abuse. Okay, but what do you say she did? Oh, but we can't tell you that. Secret evidence, secret charges. This is basically, you know, those who are paying attention to what's happening domestically in America are beginning to realize that something has gone very awry. Our judges are issuing decisions that increasingly are protecting abusive police. I mean, almost never at this point in time is a police officer successfully prosecuted for abuse or murdering a U.S. citizen.
Well, that's because they're not actually police officers anymore, Janet. They're actually just glorified thugs for the corporation.
Well, they almost are like private security officers. I mean, it's a very interesting phenomenon. So that is one piece of evidence. I believe at this point there's somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 people that they can track who are murdered every year by police.
Yeah.
Where are we getting, you know, we're not even getting prosecutions. We're not even getting grand jury indictments. It's like, well, you know, he must have had a bad day at work and fired his pistol, you know.
Yeah.
Well, bad boy. Go home and come back to work tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, I don't.
Same thing with bad guardians.
It is. Go ahead, Steven. I don't know if this is going to be a revelation to you or not, but you mentioned your boyfriend was a spook. I can assure you that there are teams of police officers out there that are, they call them hunters. And what they do is they're special teams that nobody but these two or three people know about, only to themselves. Nobody else in their own departments know, but they are placed into police departments to do these types of jobs that you're talking about. Go out and find people that are targeted individuals and eliminate them. So they are able to control the crime scenes. They are able to control the evidence, and they are able to control the outcome.
I am not surprised to hear that. I'd like to say a couple other things about my
sure.
situation and exile, because I want to make it clear how dangerous personally this got for me. I ended up leaving Jack Smith in late September of 2002. And as I'd mentioned, I'd gone back to live in this little cottage in Long Beach where, you know, I was having drugs planted in my home and other things began to happen there, which were clearly very dangerous for me. And on January 3rd of 2003, about 3 months later, I was attacked with lethal force by officers of the law in Long Beach, California, and I was in a coma. for three days.
Not surprising.
So this is not like, oh, I was afraid. Oh, my mother got hurt. Oh, I got to leave the country. When I got out of the coma, I finally woke up in the hospital. I was on a heart monitor. I was apparently very fortunate to have survived this.
You are very fortunate, indeed.
So, and what I believe, Stephen, is that my story is not unique. I believe that what has happened to me in terms of this kind of targeting may have happened to many other people who were not as fortunate as I was. I woke up.
Yes.
I got out of that coma. I had some trouble getting out of that hospital. I mean, the book kind of goes through, you know, the police assault, you know, what happened to me exactly. I name one of the involved officers is named by name. No lawsuits. I'm not being sued by anyone because basically, you know, what I have written in this book is exactly what happened to me. I know that there are people who wish that I would shut up and go away. And as one of the queries came in, you know, earlier, are you safe where you are? And the answer is not exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've committed myself to basically a course of action. And the course of action is, you know, attempting to inform and therefore protect other people.
Yeah. I've got more questions rolling in, Janet, if you don't mind.
Sure. Oh, please do.
Lori is actually a nurse at a hospital in Scotland. So she's asking some more or less legal questions. She wants to know if someone is deemed not in a frame of mind, whether falsely or not falsely, why did the trained medication administrators not sign drug sheets to protect themselves? I guess it really did it really matter to them at all, or the carer, the caregiver?
Maybe the situation in Scotland is different in the U.S. as I was attempting to explain earlier. If there is no enforcement agency that will pick up, you know, if there is basically knowledge now among police officers, adult protective services, et cetera, that guardians have a free shot at, you know, at their clients, if there's no enforcement agency in place who will do anything, then those questions are moot. There's nobody who will do anything about this. You know, there was evidence at the scene of the crime of my mother's near death. You know, there was concrete evidence. You know, the police bungled everything.
Yeah.
So, what, you know, and then when I became, you know, I became very, at that point, you know, was collecting evidence en masse. And, you know, from my attempts to collect this evidence and to bring it forward, I was nearly murdered by the police. So I don't believe that her question is, you know, she may not quite understand what happens when there is no enforcement bureau in place who will take this on.
Okay, yeah, that's possible. She would also like to know why you both were, well, I thought you covered this already, but why you were targeted. Is it?
I go into this in some depth in the book, as I am, you know, attempting to convey my sense of what happened here and what is happening, you know, on a grander scale inside the U.S. You know, the conclusions that I have about demographic targeting are basically laid out explicitly in the book. So in order, you know, to get to that depth of, you know, what groups are targeted, you know, in what means, what, you know, what sort of efforts are in place now and likely in the future, you know, I would really suggest that people might want to get the book.
Yes.
Excellent.
Well, I can also add to the money that they drain from the patients, Janet. I can also add to that there have been places that have been caught taking out life insurance policies on the elderly and then cashing in on those life insurance policies, whether they're just $1 million or $2 million or more after their death. So along with all of the assets that they get from granny or grandpa and all the money that they drain from the federal system, they also collect on the life insurance also. So I know that was a little redundant there, but
no, I've certainly heard stories of that. Yeah. And, you know, what's really interesting concerning these guardianships in general is that, well, you know, they are enormous money grabs. And if one should go into court records and start looking over the accountings, which I actually spent 2 months in San Bernardino County Courthouse going through the guardianship records, and you start looking at the accountings, even a non-legal person such as myself will see, you know, massive irregularities, numbers that don't add up, missing hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yes.
This missing, you know, it's like the guardian can't, or her accountant can't add, right? And I have made attempts to alert law enforcement as to these sorts of issues on several occasions. And you know, every time it's just like, you know, basically the reports disappear. The reports are never given. This is one way that they tend to disappear. Unwanted reports is they refuse to give a report number. So you make a complaint, it goes into the system, it doesn't exist. And because if you don't get a tracking number, if the agency refuses to give you a complaint or tracking number, you can be pretty sure that the complaint doesn't exist. And this is, you know, another means. Now, we'd have to talk about, you know, in terms of court-authorized guardianships, we'd have to talk about, you know, of necessity, the judges. Because if you have a fiduciary, a guardian who can't add, it is really incumbent upon the judge to review these records. And this is where, you know, the issue comes in of this level of, you know, protection, enforcement, you know, adjudication that has been compromised as well. And just pursuant to that, I got really interested in the judges, because after spending a couple months in this courthouse and looking at all these records, I mean, obviously, you know, judges are, you know, issuing restraining orders without hearings, you know, approving accountings where hundreds of thousands of dollars are missing, you know, these becoming, you know, very noticeable. So I started researching some of the probate judges. And one of the first things I did was pull up their loan histories, because these are public records. And I found a very disturbing pattern in the cases of many probate and family law judges. They appear to be laundering money through their home loans.
Sure.
This is actually... if you're going to take a bribe, if you're going to take, you know, money that, you know, is inappropriate in that manner, you kind of have to be careful, because anything over $10,000 that you deposit into an account is, in a sense, flagged, and questions may arise. So basically, you've got a couple of options. You can take like a big envelope full of cash, like Brian Mulroney up in Canada was caught doing, right? You know, red-handed, red-faced. I mean, what are you going to do with the cash? You can't, like, put it all at once into your account. You know, another way of doing this, and I actually found this out through my father was an investigative reporter, was basically laundering money through home loans. And this is how it works. It's real simple. Mr. X takes out a loan, Mr. Y pays it back. And it is virtually opaque. You know, the transactions about who's paying back the loan, et cetera, is not a matter of public document. So when you have a judge, for example, who's running maybe $1 million a year through his mortgage history, like taking out a loan, $1 million loan, paying it back, next year takes out another one, pays it back, you know, you begin to wonder, you know, it does raise red flags. And at this point, it has been confirmed at some levels that this is actually a bona fide means of money laundering, and judges are actually involved in this. So if we wonder why we have a compromised judiciary, besides the political pressures involved,
yes.
There's also usually a payoff.
Yes.
And so, you know, one of the important things, and I want to pass this on to people who may be, you know, concerned about their own legal matters, is, you know, follow the money and look at the home loans.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, the entire mortgage system is a fraudulent scam to begin with in that respect also. But now we've got basically a little less than 10 minutes left here. I've asked a lot of questions. Is there anything you would just like to take the floor with and ramble on for eight or nine minutes or so for? I mean, something you something you didn't get to, or?
Well,
I have other questions, but go ahead.
Well, if you have other questions, a couple things I'd like to say. I am currently writing for Russian media. I write for New Eastern Outlook, which does have a digital presence. It is a dual English-Russian language publication. And because of, you know, its lack of affiliation with U.S. media, there are really some astounding reporters involved with the effort who are doing a very good job at exposing, you know, geopolitical agendas that you will never read about in the U.S. media. So I, you know, would really encourage people to go to New Eastern Outlook to, you know, get a fresh perspective.
Yeah. Lori does have another question.
Okay.
Janet. I mentioned she's a nurse in Scotland. She has a license to work with vulnerable people here in Scotland, which makes me liable in a court of law in accordance to the Care Commission, a very powerful body that could close a hospital in 1 minute. Are you saying that there is no backup body in the U.S. to protect the vulnerable?
There's all kinds of enforcement bureaus. There's Adult Protective Services.
Okay.
And just to give an idea, give Lori an idea of what's happening with Adult Protective Services, all reports that go into them are confidential. And they have a basically unspoken policy, but it does exist.
Sure.
That if there are allegations made that the conservator is abusing their ward, they will not investigate. But basically, because of our privacy laws, it's like you make a report into a black hole.
Yeah.
You'll never hear anything again because of HIPAA and privacy laws.
Yeah.
Now that's one level of protection that we have. Another level of protection is, of course, the police. There's also the state's attorney. There is the attorney general. And as I did mention earlier, this brave and courageous and ethical attorney, Ken Ditkowski, lost his license to practice law for the act of forwarding complaints to the U.S. Attorney General's office.
Yeah.
So the enforcement bureaus certainly exist. The problem is that they are turning a blind eye to these abuses.
Sure, they're part of the corruption.
I'm glad that things are better in Scotland, Lori. I really am, because this issue of guardian abuse is not only extant in the U.S. There are now reports coming in through the CBC of similar situations in Canada. I've heard some nightmare scenarios about Australia as well. So I'm gratified to know that, you know, in Scotland, that the enforcement bureaus are intact.
Well, I think that the people over there are much, much older societies, Janet, and they've been getting bent over by the system a lot longer than Americans have. And I think that they are just less likely to put up with the system and fight back than a lot of Americans are. They really don't stand for a lot of things I've found out in the last year and a half being in this network. They would be out in the streets rioting they do get out in the streets rioting for a lot of things that we think are petty over here in America. They get out and stop evictions, people being evicted from their homes, people being evicted from their apartments or little cottages or whatever. They just go out there and stop it. Block the sheriffs, block the police over there, which are called Gardaí Síochána. They just do a lot of things about a lot of injustices that Americans won't even consider.
Well, it's very gratifying to know that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, frankly, looking at what's happening domestically in the U.S., there seems to be not a lot of concern for one's neighbor anymore. There seems to be an awful lot of focus now on self and what's best for self. What's in it for me?
Yeah, the me generation.
It seems to be really sort of the overriding ethic, in it for me. And if it involves sticking one's neck out for other people, I'm not saying there are people who aren't doing that, but the overriding ethic is really me first.
Yes.
And I'm glad to know that it hasn't spread as a contagion everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I believe they have it written right in their constitution that nobody can be forcefully removed from their from their residence, from their home. And of course, the system doesn't really care, so they try to go around the Constitution and they try to go around the laws. But you know, the people over there fight it. Mm-hmm. Well, you did promise me an hour, and that's in about 3 or 4 minutes. So if you would like to end this with a little bit of something, go ahead, Janet.
Yeah, well, I just want to, you know, reiterate that the book is entitled Exile, and it is right now only available on thebookpatch.com. So you can order the book through the Bookpatch, and they'll print and send you a copy if you're interested. And please do visit New Eastern Outlook. You know, we've got a really different sort of perspective than the U.S. media, and I think that it is a perspective that certainly enriches the, you know, the reading audience. My website, or my articles and poetry, etc., is archived, is janetphelan.com.
Okay, I'll put that in there also.
Thank you.
Sure. You know, I would almost bet we could talk another time on just things that something else, you know, other subjects that would come up in your story. I know with all the questions, we probably missed a good 10 or 15 minutes of just you telling the story.
Well, you know, I would love, I mean, if you'd like to have me come back, and, you know, I cover in actually a lot of different kinds of issues. You know, I not only write about guardian abuse, I mean, I write about, you know, I write about Monsanto. I've got an article up on New Eastern Outlook right now about these strange new, new censorship policies at Facebook and LinkedIn. I mean, I really do attempt to cover a wide range of issues. And anytime you'd like me back on to discuss,
certainly,
all kinds of things, I'd love to come back on.
Certainly. You know, a lot of people don't really know what the ad hominem attack is, but you and I and many of the listeners, many of the European listeners do. We study those things diligently. You know, I say a lot on air that the ad hominem attack, the straw man attack, is just one of their tricks that they use to try to denigrate somebody's information and try to downplay the information. They seem to be very good at it because they have a lot of the American public captivated. You know, they just point a finger at you and laugh at you and call you a name, and you seem to be discredited.
Well, they certainly try to do that to people. You know, they actually started this with my father back in the 60s. He was writing for the Saturday Evening Post and uncovered something about the Kennedy assassination. And it started with him back then. And I appear to have inherited that mantle to some degree. So, you know, we're just trying basically, you know, to get out the truth and also our perspectives on the truth. So.
Absolutely. Well, I thank you for coming on, Janet Phelan.
Thank you very much for having me on, Stephen.
And I have placed your website and your link for the book on bookpatch.com up in the chat room again. If anybody wants to go check it out. I already have a copy of it, so I will try to get on it very, very quickly.
And thank you very much.
Yes, you're welcome for coming. Thanks again for coming on. So I'm going to go ahead and let you go here and then sign out for the night.
Okay, keep the faith.
Thank you.
Bye.
Talk to you soon. All right, everyone. She just wanted an hour interview and an hour show, so that's what I promised her. It is Wednesday night here in America, so I'm not sure when the next time I'll see somebody. It's probably going to be a ninja show or something like that. So I want to thank everybody for staying up and watching the show. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this has been Cancel the Cabal. Good night, everyone.